Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. There are two laws in the United States, according to Senator Ron Wyden. He's a Democrat from Oregon who sits on the Senate Intelligence Committee.
It's important for the American people to know when the president can kill an American citizen and when they can't. And yet it is almost as if there are two laws in America. And the American people would be extraordinarily surprised if they could see the difference between what they believe a law says and how it has actually been interpreted in secret.
That's part of an interview in Dirty Wars. It's a documentary based on the award-winning investigative journalist Jeremy Scahill's new book, Dirty Wars, The World is a Battlefield. Scahill traveled through Afghanistan, Yemen, and Somalia to report on those two laws, the impact of the U.S. military's covert war on terrorism, and that shadowy world of the Joint Special Operations Command, known as JSOC. He covers national security for Nation magazine. He's also the author of the New York Times bestseller, Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army. Jeremy Scahill joins us today by phone from New York. Welcome to the show, Jeremy.
Thank you for having me.
I'll talk about it a little bit more later, but Jeremy will be in Columbus tomorrow for two events. You can go to our website and check out those links. But first, let's get to the interview. You have been covering wars for, at least when the documentary was produced, for more than a decade at that point. What triggered your particular interest in JSOC at this time?
Well, you know, I had spent years reporting on the private security industry, not just Blackwater, which is perhaps the most famous of all these mercenary companies, but contractors in general. I first came across these kinds of forces in Yugoslavia in the 1990s, working for a company called DynCorp. And a lot of the people that work for these big private security companies are working for the CIA or for the U.S. military or for the State Department. They're former military people. They're special ops people. And so I knew that there was sort of this world of soldiers that were sort of separate from the conventional U.S. military, because I had met a lot of them over the years of reporting on the privatization of war. And when I was sort of wrapping up my multi-year reporting stint on that industry and was starting to look at what other stories I wanted to pursue, President Obama was just getting sworn into office. And I started looking at the role that night raids were going to play in Afghanistan under President Obama, because, of course, President Obama had campaigned on this idea that he was going to wage a smarter war than his opponent, John McCain, if he were to be elected. And at the sort of tip of the spear of Obama's new campaign was the idea that the United States should take the fight directly to terrorist groups and to not even ask for permission to strike in sovereign countries, you know, including in the case of trying to target Osama bin Laden. So as I started going to Afghanistan after Obama was president, looking at the way that the Afghanistan war was changing, I discovered that the troops that were doing these night raids were, in fact, from this very elite secretive unit that had almost never been discussed in media coverage. Journalists weren't embedding with them. And they were these elite commandos from this entity, as you say, called the Joint Special Operations Command.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with Jeremy Scahill. He's the author of Dirty Wars, The World is a Battlefield. JSOC was established in 1980 after the Iran hostage crisis, right?
Right. I mean, people think that it's just about Argo, you know, people trying to fake a film crew to go in and rescue the hostages. But there had, in fact, been a really disastrous attempt to go into Iran, and it involved all of these U.S. Special Operations Forces. But what happened in that disastrous attempt is that some helicopters went down in a dust storm, and there was a lot of infighting between the various branches of the military, the Navy and the Army, what have you. And coming out of that mission, where there was all of this infighting that contributed to the deaths of more than half a dozen U.S. troops, elite U.S. troops, the military decided that it wanted to create essentially an all-star team that would draw the most elite forces from each of the branches of the service, and that they would work in coordinated operations on the most high-value missions, counterterrorism among them, but also hostage rescue, countering threats of weapons of mass destruction, and protecting high-value U.S. officials when they traveled around the world.
Jeremy, what do you mean by elite troops? Are they like super soldiers? Who are these people? How do they get picked? Who gets to be in JSAC?
Well, you know, just to sort of get to the nitty gritty of it. So JSOC basically is a tree with a half a dozen branches. You have on the one hand Navy SEALs from this unit that previously was called SEAL Team 6, and I'm sure many of your listeners have heard of them because of the Osama bin Laden raid.
Right.
Actually, it's been a long time since they were officially called SEAL Team 6. They're called the Naval Special Warfare Development Group. Then there's the Army's Special Operations Forces, Delta Force, as well as the Army Rangers from the 75th Ranger Regiment. Then they have the best helicopter pilots in the world called the Night Stalkers, the 160th Aviation Unit. And then they're backed up by an intelligence division that's been known as the Activity, which is sort of its own freestanding intelligence operation. And JSOC, the reason that I call it elite is because the soldiers and sailors and commandos that make up JSOC have gone through the most rigorous training in the U.S. military, some would argue in the world. Many of them go through a program called SEER, Survive, Evade, Resist, Escape, which is essentially a program that teaches U.S. soldiers how to endure torture techniques of a lawless enemy. And they go through this SEER program. In the case of the Navy SEALs, they go through this BUDS program. It takes years to build these guys. It's not like you just jump out of high school and enlist in the military, and bam, you're a member of SEAL Team 6. Many of the guys that are the tip of the spear of JSOC are in their mid-30s and have spent their entire adult lives training for conducting very sensitive missions. So these guys are definitely the kind of cream of the crop of the U.S. military. And, you know, one thing I was surprised about in reporting this story, and I get into this more in the book, not in the film, but a lot of these guys are very, very well educated. I mean, the longtime commanders of JSOC, General Stanley McChrystal, who, of course, was brought down in the Rolling Stone article after he was the Afghanistan commander, and then Admiral William McRaven, are both known as incredibly smart, well-educated guys. McRaven has a degree in journalism, actually, and I know guys who have been Navy SEALs that were neuroscientists who then enlisted because they wanted to be in the military and they wanted the challenge of rising through the ranks of the most elite force. So these guys aren't just like cowboy yahoos the way that they were portrayed in Zero Dark Thirty, for instance. Many of them are actually very, very well-educated people who also are serving in these units.
And once again, for our listeners, when we're referring to JSOC, where we mean the Joint Special Operations Command, you might remember it as the outfit that was credited for killing Osama bin Laden in 2011. When was JSOC ramped up to its present state?
Right. Well, so what happened is that, you know, as you pointed out earlier, JSOC's formed in 1980. For much of the 80s, JSOC kind of was just, you know, whispered about in hushed tones in the chamber, you know, the chambers of the Pentagon. These were the guys that you wanted them, or, you know, the president wanted them to be doing these missions in Central America, Latin America, and Africa, and Europe, and elsewhere. But you didn't want to talk about them. You certainly didn't want movies being made about them or newspaper articles being written about them. And they were kind of, you know, they were kind of viewed as the men that we dare not speak of. And then in the early 1990s, JSOC was deployed to Somalia in an effort to hunt down and capture Mohamed Farah Aidid, this infamous warlord who was one of the people that overthrew the last stable government Somalia had, the regime of Siad Barre. And of course, every American is familiar with the Black Hawk Down incident. What many people, were multiple U.S. helicopters were brought down by Somali militias. And then a dozen or so U.S. Army Rangers were dragged through the streets of Mogadishu, prompting Bill Clinton to withdraw all U.S. forces from the U.N. operation in Somalia. I bring that story up because after that incident, the Clinton administration really viewed JSOC as a risky entity to be deploying around the world. And he kind of chained JSOC to a fence in the proverbial backyard. And, you know, JSOC was only used in very surgical ways after that. They were used in Bosnia to try to hunt down war criminals. They would engage with other U.S. Nations' military forces in counterinsurgency operations. But largely, they were kind of confined to their bases. Once 9/11 happened, Donald Rumsfeld, the defense secretary, and Dick Cheney in particular, were facing a situation where they viewed the CIA as basically a liberal think tank. Now, anyone who knows the history of the CIA knows that that's sort of laughable on one level, but what they didn't want any analyst telling them, oh, well, our intelligence contradicts your political conclusions. They basically wanted to just have people that would implement the policy. And JSOC was viewed by Cheney and Rumsfeld in particular as this entity that had very little involvement with congressional oversight, didn't even operate within the official chain of military command, and had highly trained individuals who not only were used to conducting operations that would never be made public, but had felt that they had been sidelined for much of the previous decade. And so JSOC really started to become the policy early on after 9/11, particularly because of Donald Rumsfeld's vision of the world. You fast forward to the Obama era, and I think, you know, President Obama comes into office. He has very limited foreign policy experience. He had no military experience, and he's briefed by the military brass and by the various heads of U.S. intelligence agencies, and they paint a picture for him of a world where there are hundreds, if not thousands, of concurrent threats against the U.S. He doesn't want to stick people in Guantanamo. He doesn't want to, ratchet up U.S. troop involvement in multiple countries across the globe. So I think President Obama viewed JSOC as the sort of least bad option for him and embraced the idea that the U.S. could preempt threats against the country by deploying these commandos in night raids or using drone strikes to hunt down and kill terrorists before they could carry out their plots against the United States. That's what I think was official.
A little bit of an irony there, though, is that at the time, President Obama's Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton's spouse of the same president who tamped down the organization.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, you know, it's interesting. Once you're in power, I think, and you're briefed by the military, it's very difficult to stand up to the recommendations of the brass. And I also think that, 9/11 did change the U.S. perspective on it. I mean, if you look at President Clinton, immediately following 9/11, was very aggressive in his support of the Bush administration, certainly not of the buildup to the Iraq War, but in the immediate post 9/11 response. And I think that Democrats tried to embrace this idea that they could wage a cleaner, smarter way of war. No doubt there's an irony there. But, you know, Hillary Clinton is also not Bill Clinton, and very much has her own legacy and has carved out her own foreign policy vision during the course of her time as Secretary of State.
My guest is Jeremy Scahill. He's an award-winning investigative journalist and the author of Dirty Wars, The World is a Battlefield. Jeremy will be in Columbus tomorrow for two events. WOSU News Director Mike Thompson interviews him in person at the Columbus Metropolitan Club. Tickets are still available for that. And Jeremy, also a producer on Dirty Wars, the documentary we're talking about as well, joins director Richard Rowley for a conversation about that and a screening of the film at the Wexner Center. So we have links on our website at WOSU.org/allsides if you want more information. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Next time on Here and Now, Democrats in Kentucky have been scrambling to find a candidate who could give Senator Mitch McConnell a run for his money. Have they found one in Kentucky's Secretary of State? Also, what role did the U.S. play in Mohamed Morsi's last days in office in Egypt? That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon from 2 till 4 on 89.7 NPR News.
Program support is provided by the Arts and College Prep Academy. ACPA is now enrolling high school students looking for a safe and vigorous learning environment for all. More information about ACPA can be found online at artcollegeprep.org.
The WOSU Member Card Benefit of the Month for July is the Columbus Children's Theater. Enjoy 2-for-1 admission all month long. Visit WOSU.org.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. This hour, we're talking to award-winning investigative journalist Jeremy Scahill about his new book, Dirty Wars, The World is a Battlefield. A film based on the book will be playing at the Wexner Center for the Arts tomorrow night. Let's hear a bit from the trailer for the film.
I got a strange phone call. Someone from the inside was reaching out to me. Someone close to the heart of the president's elite force.
There are hundreds of covert operations on multiple continents with the full support of the White House.
It's hard to say when this story began.
Greetings from Kabul, Afghanistan.
This was supposed to be the front line in the war on terror.
What's the name of this village out here?
But I knew I was missing the story. There was another war hidden in the shadows.
That is Jeremy Scahill narrating the film. For more information about that screening tomorrow night, you can go to our website at WOSU.org/allsides. If you have a question or comment for Jeremy Scahill, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@WOSU.org or check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. Well, we've been talking about the Joint Special Operations Command, known as JSOC. Jeremy, you said that because we have someone like President Obama in office, the risk of JSOC becoming permanent is very real. Why does having Obama there make a difference now?
Well, I mean, JSOC is permanent. I mean, it's not so much JSOC. What I was referring to was the institution of assassination as a central component of U.S. national security policy is going to become permanent. And the reason I say that is because I think particularly for a lot of liberals in the United States, the Bush-Cheney era represented this kind of dark moment in U.S. history where you had kind of a lawless attitude that the United States could go anywhere that it wanted and didn't need to pay any attention to international law, not to mention U.S. laws when it came to surveillance and other things, that they had invaded and occupied Iraq based on fraudulent evidence that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction, the opening of the Guantanamo prison camp. And I think that a lot of liberals sort of perceived it as, well, this was Bush and Cheney doing that. But now we're going to have Obama and we're going to roll all of that back and we're going to change things. What actually has happened under President Obama is that if you look at some of the key components of the Bush-Cheney counterterrorism apparatus, President Obama has either continued them or in many cases expanded the authorities. And certainly in the case of JSOC's operations, President Obama has given them much wider latitude to strike in countries that the U.S. does not have a declared war against. Yemen, for instance, was bombed once during the entire duration of the Bush-Cheney administration. President Obama has regularly conducted or authorized drone strikes in Yemen, cruise missile strikes, targeted killing operations of U.S. commandos on the ground. He's escalated the covert U.S. war within the borders of Somalia and has expanded the number of U.S. drone bases in Eastern Africa and around the Arabian Peninsula. President Obama continues to make use of secret prisons in countries around the world that are technically not run by the CIA, but instead run by what I would call sort of client states of the United States. He's failed to close Guantanamo and has, in fact, authorized JSOC and the CIA to hold prisoners at times on naval brigs in oceans. So, my point there was that I think a lot of liberals are supporting policies under President Obama that they would have been against if it was a Republican in office. And I think it just sort of shows the bankrupt nature of partisan politics in our country, where you answer a question about what you think of a policy based on who's in office and if they're your guy or not, rather than what do you actually think about the policy.
You mentioned that the Bush administration referred to CIA as a liberal think tank. But the secret war you describe in the film sounds an awful like how the CIA operated in Central America in the 1970s, which is when I grew up. It was typical. We were always hearing about how they were propping up one leader, bringing down another one, installing another one more friendly to the United States. And it was always the same thing. That's just the way we have to do business. It was secretive, but we knew it was going on.
Right. So, that history I get into in great depth in the book. And basically my answer is this: you're totally right. And that's part of why we call it Dirty Wars, as a sort of macabre tip of the hat to that other era. Mm-hmm. And so what you saw happen is that 50s, 60s, 70s, you have, and also to an extent in the 80s, you had the CIA deeply involved with coups, with propping up dictatorships, with assassinating, various pro-democracy leaders or rebel leaders that were trying to overthrow U.S.-backed dictatorships. And Congress then eventually stepped in and formed the Church Committee, named after, you know, of course, the late Senator Frank Church, and began to try to dismantle that Murder, Inc. operation. And so Cheney and Rumsfeld both cut their teeth politically at a time when the CIA was kind of being put in a cage. And I think that what they felt happened is that the generation of CIA personnel that grew up in the aftermath of the Church Committee were far less aggressive than they should have been. And Cheney and Rumsfeld definitely embraced the actions that you were describing in Central America, not as a scandal, but as a model for how the U.S. should be conducting its foreign policy. And first of all, people should understand, we can't paint the CIA with a broad brush. Those guys were viewing the analytical division of the CIA, the people that were responsible for presenting the threat assessments, determining U.S. intelligence, the veracity of the information. They viewed them as a liberal think tank. The paramilitary division of the CIA has long worked in close relation with JSOC and other U.S. military entities. And so they kind of tried to segregate off the part of the CIA that they liked, the paramilitary division, and then put them working in concert with JSOC. But you're absolutely right. I mean, the CIA has long been involved with these sorts of actions and increasingly is back into that game as well under President Obama. I mean, that really is what's happened over the past 5 years, is that the CIA has been in a kind of race with the military over who will have sovereign domain over the campaign to hunt down and kill terrorists. And so you've seen a re-paramilitarization of the CIA.
Good portion. You mentioned that the bombings have increased quite a bit in Yemen, and a good portion of the film revolves around the rise and fall by the hands of JSOC of Anwar al-Awlaki, an American cleric who became radicalized and left the U.S. for Yemen. He was the first American citizen placed on a kill list by President Obama. He has been assassinated since then, as well as his son. Can you talk about that story a little bit?
Right. So, I mean, you know, for me, I'm sure many of your listeners, those who are familiar with the name Anwar al-Awlaki, probably know a handful of things about him. You can go on YouTube and look at videos of the guy dressed in a camouflage jacket in front of the black flag that is commonly associated with al-Qaeda, calling for attacks against the United States and saying that, you know, Muslims in the West should either rise up in their own countries or should join the Mujahideen and the fronts of jihad around the world. And that's basically the story about al-Awlaki that we all know. What we tried to do in this film is to answer a question: how does someone who was born in New Mexico, who has incredibly responsible parents who are upstanding citizens and academics, how does he become the guy on that YouTube video? And what we discovered in investigating al-Awlaki's life is that he was really transformed by the U.S. response to 9/11, the invasion of Iraq, the opening of Guantanamo, the torture of prisoners at Abu Ghraib and other U.S. prisons. And so you see this guy really morph from being a media figure after 9/11. I mean, he was on TV, on the radio, in the newspapers because he was an imam of a prominent mosque in Virginia. He was condemning the 9/11 attacks. He was condemning al-Qaeda, saying they had perverted the religion of Islam. He was so popular and such a respected member of the commentariat after 9/11 that he was actually invited to give a lecture at the Pentagon. And he went and gives this lecture on the state of Islam in the world today at the Department of Defense. And then you fast forward to a few years later, and al-Awlaki has become quite radical. And so we were trying to say in the film, you know, let's look at how people become sworn enemies of the United States, including American citizens, and then how do we as a society respond to them? I'm willing to concede for the sake of argument that everything that the U.S. government has alleged about al-Awlaki is true, that he was involved with the Christmas Day bomb plot, the so-called underwear bomber who tried to blow up that plane over Detroit on Christmas Day 2009, and that he was looking at plots to poison U.S. water supplies. If all of that is true, what should our response as a society be? Do we just fast forward to the death penalty phase if someone is not representing an imminent threat to the United States? Or do we charge them with a crime and try to put them on trial? You know, the thing to remember about this is that President Obama authorized the assassination of a U.S. citizen 2 years before he was actually assassinated and never bothered to seek an indictment against him. And for me, that's the real issue here. What rights do we as citizens have, even when we are reprehensible, heinous people, to respond to allegations against us? What the standard shouldn't be set by law-abiding citizens or the people that we adore and love. It should be set by the tough cases where someone actually is engaged in criminal activity. You know, Charles Manson is in prison right now. Charles Manson never killed a single person himself, but he directed others to do it. We didn't just go and assassinate Charles Manson. We put him on trial, we charged him with a crime, and now justice is served. He's in prison.
Is the president the only one who can put names on the kill list? You said there are thousands on it now.
No, the president. So, there, first of all, by my understanding through my reporting, there are three separate kill lists.
Okay.
There may be more, but there are three separate kill lists that are maintained by the U.S. government. One is handled by the CIA. One is handled by the military, and that's largely the Joint Special Operations Command. And then the other is a very sensitive, smaller list that is governed by the National Security Council, which is basically a handful of the president and a handful of senior officials, the vice president, secretary of defense, national security advisor. And in the cases of very high-value targets, the president is the one who signs off on it. But in the case of, let's say, Afghanistan, where, you know, Afghanistan and Pakistan is probably where most of the people on the kill list reside. In the case of Afghanistan, the U.S. military has its own list of people that it is hunting down to try to kill or capture. President Obama is not micromanaging that and sitting there saying, in Wardak province, we're going to go after this sub-commander of the Taliban. But in the case of the global campaign, particularly when it comes to American citizens, the president signs off on all of them. In the case of drone strikes that are aimed at specific individuals, the president is signing off on those every time.
How much do we know, how much do you know about why names get put on the list? What triggers a listing?
Well, I mean, there's what's said in public, and then there's what's not said in public.
Mm-hmm.
What the official line on this is that, you know, individuals that the U.S. believes it cannot apprehend and who pose a grave and imminent threat to the United States can be put on that list to be killed. Now, what is the definition of imminent? The Obama administration has defined it as anyone who was ever believed to have been engaged in a plot against the United States will forever represent an imminent national security threat to the United States. That's not my understanding of the definition of imminent, and lawyers throughout the country and major legal organizations have challenged the Obama administration's definition of imminent. But the real fact is that members of Congress who have asked to see the standards used, particularly to put an American on the kill list, have been stonewalled by both the Bush and the Obama administration. You played the clip of Senator Ron Wyden at the top of the show. Wyden's been on the Intelligence Committee since 9/11, and he has waged this battle to try to compel the administration to provide at least to Congress, at least to the people who are on the Intelligence Committee and who by law are supposed to be overseeing covert actions, to provide them with the full extent of the legal justification for the entire assassination program. And the Obama administration has refused to share, even with Congress, the full extent of the rationalization or the attempt to rationalize or legalize the kill program. The state of oversight right now of this program is very, very shameful, I think. And when we as journalists try to get information on this, we're stonewalled. There was a story that came out yesterday how the administration is moving all of the documents on the bin Laden raid from the military over to the CIA so that they will not be made public, so that they can remain classified.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, we're at a moment where journalists are under attack, where whistleblowers are being prosecuted, and where there is sort of this information war going on. And I find it really disturbing that it seems to be more of a challenge, at least in my experience, to get information out of the Obama administration than it was under the Bush-Cheney administration. And they were terrible with oversight or cooperating with journalists.
Yeah, I think you're referring to, there was buried in today's dispatch, it might have been yesterday's New York Times, about this short story about how Admiral William McRaven, you referred to earlier, has ordered military files about the 2011 raid that killed bin Laden to be purged from Defense Department computers and sent to the CIA.
Correct. Yeah.
Okay. That's what
you're... And, you know, I mean, this gets into, Right, that's what I'm referring to. I mean, this gets into some tricky territory because the Bin Laden raid was technically done under the CIA, but the people that did the raid were from the Joint Special Operations Command. And the reason that they did it that way is so that if the mission went wrong, the U.S. could deny that it was involved with it at all. And this happens all the time because it was classified as a covert action. And so if the mission had gone wrong, or if soldiers had been killed, the U.S. could have put out a cover story and it would have been lawful under U.S. law to do so. If the military had just conducted it as a clandestine operation, under U.S. law, ultimately the U.S. would have had to own responsibility for it. So you can understand it from a tactical standpoint why they would want to do that. But then what this story is indicating is that the military is trying to say, oh, well, this was actually a CIA operation, so we should move all of the information over there. And in reality, it was a military operation. So I think they're playing with U.S. law there to try to prevent information from being made public.
Yeah, the CIA is saying that Bin Laden mission was overseen by the CIA, then CIA director Leon Panetta. But you note in the film that famous portrait of our leaders watching the raid, the one that was amended, had the
right,
photo
exactly.
That had Hillary Clinton taken out of it in some places. Anyways, that the famous portrait of our leaders watching the raid on the monitor, that the man at the head of the table was McRaven's assistant, not
right, that's
Leon
exactly
Panetta.
Right. Or President Obama. Obama's in the room wearing his golf outfit,
right?
And he's sitting in a folding chair. Actually, mm-hmm. He's not even in one of the leather chairs. And the guy who's sitting there is General Webb, who at the time was Admiral McRaven's deputy at JSOC, and he's running the operation. And you know, I mean, I don't mean to imply in that there's been some kind of like military coup or something. What I'm saying though is that it shows who really is in control at the end of the day of these operations. It's not the commander-in-chief of the military. It's these guys from a largely unaccountable, secretive military unit.
You talked about the normalization of JSOC once secret. Once again, we're referring to the Joint Special Operations Command. It is now maybe not quite a household phrase, but certainly familiar to most Americans who followed the Bin Laden assassination, which is most Americans. What do you make of that normalization? They wanted it secret before. When you were doing your reporting for this, it was difficult to, it was very, very secretive, very shadowy. Now,
yeah.
You know, oh yeah, it's JSOC.
Well, I mean, for me, the moment where I really just sort of sat jaw on the floor was when I was watching CNN, I don't know, a couple of days after the Bin Laden raid, and a story comes on about how the Disney Corporation tried to trademark the phrase SEAL Team 6 so that they could, I don't know, presumably make a made-for-TV movie or action figures or what have you. They ultimately failed to get the trademark on it. But the point was that I think most Americans, they may not know JSOC, but they know SEAL Team 6, which mm-hmm. is what they really mean when they say SEAL Team 6 is JSOC. I think part of it is that there has been a glorification in our society of the kind of image of the American warrior. And I think, you know, that part of it has to do with video games and part of it has to do with how it's portrayed in Hollywood. But also I think that there was this desire for people to say, you know, we won. This was a victory. We killed Osama bin Laden. And the men who did it were the noble, you know, warriors who are in the trenches for America on any given day. And I think that that's where a lot of this comes from, the idea that we, you know, we're a society that loves heroes and want, you know, we want to hold up heroes. And I think that the way this was presented to the media with no context, no backstory on who is JSOC. What about the other night raids that they had done in Afghanistan or Pakistan where pregnant women were killed or U.S. allies were killed based on faulty intelligence? None of that is ever brought up. It's just, these are the guys who went in and took out this infamous terrorist, Osama bin Laden, and let's all watch Zero Dark Thirty and, you know, and cheer the whole thing on.
My guest is Jeremy Scahill, author of a new book. It's called Dirty Wars, The World is a Battlefield. Jeremy will be in Columbus tomorrow for two events. WOSU News Director Mike Thompson interviews him in person at the Columbus Metropolitan Club. Tickets are still available. And Jeremy, also producer of Dirty Wars, the documentary based on the book, joins director Richard Rowley for a conversation about and a screening of the film at the Wexner Center. If you want to go to our website, we'll have links to both events for more information at WOSU.org/allsides. If you have a question or comment for Jeremy, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@WOSU.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Support comes from Wexner Heritage Village, home of geriatric planning solutions. Now there's a GPS for families navigating the complex and changing landscape of senior health care. More on Wexner Heritage Village's geriatric planning solutions at whv.org.
On the next Fresh Air, journalist Alfredo Corchado, who spent years covering the violence of drug cartels in Mexico. Once at a restaurant in Laredo, Texas, two young men came in with a warning.
One of them takes his hand out and points at me and does like he was using a gun. Bam, bam, bam.
Corchado's new memoir is called Midnight in Mexico. Join us.
Today at noon on 89.7 NPR News.
Support comes from the Columbus Jazz Orchestra. The eighth season of Jazz Zoo kicks off Friday, July 12th with Soul Classics. Los Angeles-based soul R&B artist Chris Pierce joins the CJO to salute the legendary figures of soul, including Sam Cooke, Otis Redding, and many more. Details at jazzartsgroup.org.
You're mobile, and we are too. Now you can get 89.7 NPR News anytime, anywhere with the free WOSU Public Media mobile app. It features live audio streaming, news stories on demand, and podcasts of your favorite shows. Just go to wosu.org/mobile app and download the app today.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Jeremy Scahill, author of a new book. It's called Dirty Wars. The World is a Battlefield. There's also a documentary based on the book that'll be screened at the Wexner Center tomorrow night. And you can go to our website for more information on that and other appearances by Jeremy in Columbus tomorrow. WOSU.org/allsides is where to go. Jeremy, there was a lot of interest in Congress in your reporting on Blackwater. We talked about that earlier in the program, but not so much JSOC and its operations. Once again, the Joint Special Operation Command. What do you make of that?
Well, I think part of it is you have to look at who's in control of the Congress. I mean, at the time that I was doing the Blackwater story, the Democrats were in control of the House of Representatives, and for instance, Representative Henry Waxman, who was the chair of the Oversight Committee, was very concerned with the issue of mercenaries operating on the U.S. payroll, and I think also the fact that Blackwater was perceived to be a Republican company under a Republican administration, getting no-bid contracts and engaging in these operations, made it more politically expedient for the Democrats to focus on. Now you have the Republicans in control of the House, and they're, you know, concerned about, is President Obama a citizen, and, you know, at turning Benghazi into the second coming of 9/11. And I think that they've just been historical backers of these kinds of forces and these kinds of actions. So I think it's one area where the most powerful Democrats and the most powerful Republicans are more or less on the same page. They both embrace the drone program. They both embrace covert military action. They're both embracing the CIA. And I think taking on a private corporation that is the recipient of hundreds of millions of dollars in contracts with U.S. taxpayer money is easier for Congress members to go after than units within the U.S. military. It's sort of the sacred cow. You don't touch it.
You traveled to several countries to root out JSOC operations. Describe what you believe to be the depth and the breadth of this organization. You talked about it earlier, the number, you know, the increase in bombings in different countries. But there's, what, something like 70 countries they're operating in now?
Yeah, right. And in fact, I mean, you know, the Admiral McRaven, who was the commander of the Joint Special Operations Command, JSOC, and is a character in our film, mm-hmm. He now is the head of all, at the end of the film, you see he gets promoted. He is now the head of all special operations forces around the globe. And he said recently that on any given day, the U.S. has these commandos in as many as 100 countries at the same time. It was once 45, then it went up to more than 70. Now on any given day, it could be 100. Now, they're not bumping people off in 100 countries around the world on mm-hmm. any given day. They're embedded with special forces of other nations' military. For instance, more recently, in hunting down al-Qaeda figures in Mali, JSOC operators have embedded with counter-narcotics forces in Mexico and in other Latin American countries. Sometimes they're training. Sometimes they are working in concert with other agencies of the U.S. government. And sometimes they're doing unilateral operations where they are spending months following an individual that they want to snatch. And they're going to take that person, and no one's ever going to know that they were abducted. The family of that person won't know. The home government won't know. Perhaps even the CIA won't know. And they'll snatch those people and take them out, or they'll just kill them. And so in you know, any of these countries around the world, any number of actions could be taking place. In the case of Pakistan, you know, JSAC has had its own drone program parallel to the CIA's. It also has run targeted killing operations on the ground inside of Pakistan beyond just the bin Laden raid. In Somalia, the U.S. is working with a network of warlords, putting them on the payroll to hunt down people associated with an organization called Al-Shabaab, mm-hmm. which is a militant organization that pledged its allegiance to Al-Qaeda. And so, yeah, I mean, it's an expansive network that's been built up really post 9/11 in countries across the globe.
There's a, I can't remember if he's a warlord, he's something in Somalia, and he's been contracted by JSOC or the CIA or the American government, one or the other, to, he's a kind of a contract employee in Somalia, and he refers to Americans as these great war teachers.
Yeah, great teachers. Yeah.
I mean, it's almost like they're from a foreign. It's almost like it's from another planet, and they're saying these aliens from another world came and taught us how to do this.
Well, I mean, no one needs to teach Somali warlords how to engage in war.
Yeah.
But I think that your viewers who haven't seen it yet, you know, we're in Somalia and we're talking to these various warlords who are on the U.S. payroll and are being paid to hunt down people on behalf of the United States. And one of the original warlords that did this guy Mohamed Kanyare, when I'm talking to him about the work that he did for, you know, for the CIA and for JSOC, you know, he kind of stops me at one point and says, you know, look, we don't need to teach them anything. The Americans are the teachers here. Like, they know what they're doing. And I think for me, it was the sort of irony of hearing a Somali warlord say, you think we're good at this game? Man, you got to look at your own people. They're even better.
You know, also in the paper today, President Obama said he is seriously considering speeding up the withdrawal of troops from Afghanistan. Do you assume or not that will include the JSOC forces, or is this completely a separate entity?
Well, look, I mean, when President Obama is talking about the withdrawal from Afghanistan, he's talking about the conventional U.S. military, getting out the Marines, the Army, you know, the conventional U.S. soldiers, getting them out of Afghanistan. What is going to endure there, and we're seeing this pop back up in Iraq, is that you are going to have an enduring presence of U.S. Special Operations Forces and CIA paramilitary forces that are going to remain in Afghanistan even after we're told that the withdrawal is complete. So the way I view it is that there are sort of two wars in Afghanistan. The conventional war, where you have embedded journalists traveling around and there's, you know, water irrigation projects, all this stuff going on. And then there's this other war, which is the secret war, which is targeting leadership of the Taliban, the Haqqani network, what's left of al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. That's going to continue on in Afghanistan, in Pakistan, and in Iraq for many, many years to come.
You ask a lot of questions at the end of the film. I won't blow it for you, but about whether the war on terror has become a self-fulfilled prophecy is one of them. But who started the war on terror? A lot of people might ask that. Wasn't it started by al-Qaeda and bin Laden and that lot? I mean, they started this secret war. How else do you fight a war against such people and such organizations?
Right. Well, I mean, you know, I think that's the dominant view is that, well, you know, al-Qaeda attacked us on 9/11, and we had to respond, and they created the world as a battlefield. Well, what created al-Qaeda? What was the motivation for the attacks against the United States? I mean, this has been going on for many, many decades. Mm-hmm. We were deeply involved in Afghanistan in an effort to expel the Soviet Union when it was occupying the country or attempting to occupy the country. And we ended up giving aid and support to very unsavory people who then later turned back around and attacked us. But just to sort of take the question at face value the way that I think you mean it, certainly the United States had a right to respond to 3,000 of our people being killed. I mean, I'm speaking to you from New York right now. The office where I was working at the time of 9/11 was blocks from ground zero. I knew people that were killed in the attack against the Trade Center. I mean, all of us, I think, stood in horror. The issue is, how do you respond to something like that? Mm-hmm. And I think what, you know, when we're looking at a situation where I'm talking to you in 2013, and it is 12 years removed from 9/11. and we are targeting people on the laws passed after 9/11 to hunt down those responsible for the attacks. We're targeting people who were toddlers on 9/11 who could not possibly have had a connection to it. I think we have to ask, like, how far across the line have we stepped right now? And I think that, you know, part of what's happened is that we're operating out of fear, and we've embraced this notion of pre-crime, that we can preempt the attacks against us. And you know, what I want people to take away from the film or from this discussion is that we have to have a serious debate about what an actual national security policy looks like. Because my fear is that in pursuit of some admittedly atrocious, terrible criminal people, we are killing a lot of innocent people. And I'm afraid that it's going to make more new enemies than it is killing actual terrorists. And that's my concern at this moment.
A lot of the film does revolve around the human aspect of all of this, not a lot of what we've been talking about, but about real people and real places who were in the middle of a big celebration of celebrating the birth of a child when they were shot and killed.
Right. I mean, this was in Afghanistan in a place called Gardez. And without getting into every detail of that story, I'll talk about it in a broad stroke, which is this. Many of my friends in the military who have been in Afghanistan, including people who have worked on what's called the high-value targeting campaign, all sort of tell me the same story, and that is that the U.S. intelligence is so terrible in these countries that, you know, we're doing night raids where we don't even, you know, have actual evidence that the people that we're raiding are involved with terrorism. And in the case of one of the stories that we tell in the film, you know, American commandos come in, they end up shooting five people, two of whom are pregnant women, and they did that based on the idea that these guys were Taliban. And it turns out later that not only were these people not Taliban, but that the family included police commanders who were fighting against the Taliban. And what I've seen repeatedly in Afghanistan is a situation where Afghans will come to an American base and they will report other Afghans as being Taliban or making improvised explosive devices used to attack U.S. soldiers in an effort to get the Americans to raid their house and either kill them or capture them. And they're doing it to settle their own personal grudges. And they know that the U.S. intelligence system in Afghanistan is not very effective.
They're dumping.
So
you said earlier, or maybe I listened to it on the phone, that they're dumping billions and billions and billions into this operation, into this joint, into JSOC. How can their intelligence be so bad that somebody can walk on base, tell them that somebody's building, you know, improvised weapons, and they take their word for it and go off and shoot them down?
Well, it's more complicated than one person doing it. I mean, Afghans have studied the system. They know that what are called HUMINT reports, human intelligence reports, can trigger a night raid. So it's not like they just show up one day and then that night there's a raid. It's that a guy will tell his nephew, go to the base on this day, and then he'll tell, you know, his cousin, go on this other day, and they'll spread it out over the course of a few weeks. And from the American perspective, these are three separate intelligence reports that indicate there are some very bad people in this compound. And then when they come into the compound that night, somebody comes out wielding a Kalashnikov. Oh, my God, well, it's Taliban. Boom, they shoot him. It turns out the people inside thought that they were being robbed or that the Taliban was coming to kill them. But you ask a good question, and I think it's one that the intelligence community is grappling with right now. Outside of Afghanistan, which is an actual war zone, in a place like Yemen, for instance, where we've also killed a lot of innocent people, and we've, you know, very serious bad people have been killed too, but we've killed a lot of innocent people. Why is that? Well, part of it is because we've outsourced our intelligence operations to the Saudis or to a network of corrupt informants in the country, and we're relying very heavily on drones and signals intercepts, you know, intercepting phone calls or trying to pinpoint travel patterns of people. And we're largely out of the old-fashioned spy game in a place like Yemen, where you actually are working assets and trying to get actionable intelligence. We basically have just outsourced the whole thing, and a lot of the money is spent on the toys of war now, the drones and the missiles and the planes and whatnot, and not so much on actually cultivating sources and assets and agents.
You predicted blowout from this covert form of war, and I know there was blowout from the last covert form of war, a la the CIA and Central America and so forth. What kind of blowout are you expecting now?
Well, it's blowback is the term.
I'm sorry, blowback. Yeah, blowback.
Chalmers Johnson, who really predicted what was going to happen, you know, not in specific with 9/11, but basically said, you know, when we're doing all these actions around the world, particularly in the Muslim world, it's going to come back around to hit us. You know, my concern is domestic terrorism, you know, that we are going to inspire people through our actions within the United States to want to commit attacks here, and that they'll believe that they're doing it on the basis that we killed innocent people in drone strikes, or that, you know, we had Guantanamo or Abu Ghraib. And, you know, I think that you could argue also that the attack on the consulate in Benghazi was already a form of blowback, you know, because the U.S. was engaged in all sorts of covert actions leading up to the siege on our consulate that ended up killing Ambassador Stevens. And I think that what you're going to see, maybe not in a year or two, maybe 5 years down the line, is that we are breeding a whole new generation of young people who are growing up in Muslim and Arab countries, viewing the United States as a nation that operates with impunity, regardless of who the president is, whether it's a Republican like Bush or a Democrat like Obama. And that's really resonated with me strongly in my travels around the Muslim world, is this idea that the next generation coming up will have grown up in a constant sort of state of war. And their perspective on the United States may be very different than their parents or grandparents.
Jeremy Scahill, thanks so much for joining us today.
It was my honor to be with you. Thank you very much.
Jeremy Scahill, award-winning investigative journalist, the author of a new book. It's called Dirty Wars, The World is a Battlefield. He'll be in Columbus for two events tomorrow. WOSU News Director Mike Thompson interviews him in person at the Columbus Metropolitan Club. Tickets are still available. And Jeremy, also producer of Dirty Wars, based on his book, joins director Richard Rowley for a conversation about and screening of the film at the Wexner Center. For more information, go to our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Thanks very much for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.